there. This is Jo McGarry. Welcome to our podcast. A little different from Radio Mojo, the radio show. The podcasts are meant to be a more private, more intimate, more in-depth look behind the scenes with our guests and continuing to bring you the best of eating, drinking, and living in Hawaii. If you want to know more about what we do and our work specifically with restaurants and food clients, then you can go to our website, mojomcgarry.com. And this podcast can be downloaded through iTunes or any of the other places where you like to get your podcasts. Enjoy, and thanks for being with us. This edition of our podcast is brought to you by Pieology Pizzeria, now with locations in Kailua, Aina Haina, Pearl Ridge, and University Avenue. Create your own custom pizza with a new selection of specialty crusts, including house-made thin, house-made whole wheat, house-made thick, gluten-free, and my favorite, cauliflower. All of those choices before you even choose the topping. When they say custom-made pizza, they really mean it. Check out Pieology at their existing Hawaii locations and keep listening to hear of the new locations coming soon. For more information on Pieology, opening hours, and locations, simply go to pieology.com. Hey, welcome back to our part two of our podcast with Kunoa. We're talking local beef today, and I'm so happy that we have with us Brian Mayer, who is what we would call the butcher. He's the director of product at Kunoa. Hello, how are you?
I'm great. How are you doing?
I'm doing good. Thank you so much for being with us.
Yeah,
I'm genuinely really can't wait to chat with you to get the wealth of your knowledge on how we should cook and what we should look for when we go shopping. But before we do, tell us just a wee bit about your history and how did you come to be a butcher?
Oh, how much time do we have?
You can tell your story. We're interested.
It's a roundabout sort of thing happened. I was not in food or agriculture whatsoever. I have a degree in economics and finance that I did very little with. I guess it just showed that I could open up a book and study. But I'm a musician and was a musician for the bulk of my life, which was wonderful and fantastic. And then that became very difficult. I had a brief stint in advertising, just long enough to realize that that wasn't for me. But I write, so it was an outlet for writing. I grew up in a very stereotypical sort of a New York Italian family. My mom is was Sicilian. So there was lots of cooking. You know, grandparents had a kitchen upstairs and a kitchen downstairs when it was too hot, and big family get-togethers, and we were all helping. So that was always a part of my life. And so I thought maybe that was the next move for me. Talked to some chef friends, and obviously they talked me out of going to culinary school and all those sorts of things. And I hopped on their lines and restaurants and stuff, and they were very gracious to let me in there and really got the bug. There was a little gourmet market opening up in a neighborhood that I lived near in Brooklyn. They were just finishing building. I walked in and said, hey, I don't know anything about this, but I would love to work here. This is what I want to do. And then I just started making my way around the shop. I started with fish, and they had a fishmonger there, and he had a boat out of Sheepshead Bay in Brooklyn. So he took me out and showed me everything he knew about, like, catching fish and all that you needed to do with that. And then I worked with the cheesemonger, whose parents had a cheese shop in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and he showed me everything he knew about that. And finally, there was a butcher there, and I just kind of gravitated towards that. Mm-hmm. And we just got on really well, and he kind of showed me what he knew. And that was all happening right at the sort of the genesis of the craft butcher movement, which was a little bit different than what was happening before in the butchery world. And so I just really started to immerse myself in that, and then found myself up in the Hudson Valley, sort of at the beginning of this shop known as Fleischer's, which was, I guess I can call it the mecca of meat, if you will, where just people just gravitated towards that, wanted to learn everything about meat, and started doing a little bit of farming, got into slaughter, got into butchery, and the rest is history. Yeah.
And that's the amazing thing about your craft, is that it's one of the professions that that's what's old and what always was is new again. It's like the craft beer movement. I mean, beer is probably our first food, some people say, and it's new again. It's people are, they're reinvigorated by it. They really want to do it, but do it better. And when I was watching you slaughtering, well, not slaughtering, but when I was watching you completely breaking down a pig, the level of perfection in your work is quite extraordinary. Did that come naturally to you when you say that you were sort of, you gravitated towards the butchery? Was that something that you immediately thought, oh, I'm very good at this? Or are you just a very, very precise person in life?
I don't know if I'm very good at it now. I think to me, there was a correlation and connection between music and that, and trained as a bass player and obviously very hands-on. Mm-hmm. And so for me to be able to translate how I played music into how I cut meat just seemed supernatural to do that.
I get that connection. Okay. So we've established how you got to, well, almost to Hawaii. We'll go into that a little bit later. So one of the things that we wanted to really use this interview for this morning, Brian, is that I think a lot of people, when they go shopping, they're just a wee bit lost in the supermarket. There's so much there. There's so much to choose from. And when it comes to meat, I think some people just look at the cuts and they're just like, well, I'm not sure what that's for. Let's try and see if it's going to be okay.
Sure.
When it comes to grass-fed meat, I think in particular people think, well, I've heard that. I don't know. I tried it once. It was a bit chewy. It was a bit tough. There's just a whole world out there of how to buy and how to cook. Where do we start?
Yeah. Well, I think one of the things that the craft butcher movement did was sort of start the idea that there was more than just the middle meats, right? So your ribeye or your New York strip or your tenderloin. And so that's really what a lot of the commodity market was built upon, and a ton of ground beef, obviously, because that's where all the rest of it would go. But sort of to maximize the economy of the animal, what the craft butcher did was take it back even farther and start to look at how the animal was put together, sort of using a process called seam cutting. So following the muscle structures and looking at the fat, the bones, and all of that, and pulling out all these individual little muscles that, for the most part, in the commodity system would wind up in trim going into grind, and really finding out that there's tons of flavor there, there's tenderness, right? There's just so much more there that the consumer should know about. So the butcher started to become more of the salesperson. And so now you see, you know, when you look at a cut chart for the United States and compare that to other countries, we've got, you know, maybe half the cuts mm-hmm. coming off the animal, right? So you're Scottish, right? And so right. if you look at a Scottish cut chart, right,
it's
like there's, full. I don't know, 30, 40 different cuts maybe. Somebody, I'm sure, will correct me.
And the butcher shops, when you go into the butcher shop, it's just huge.
And it's not just ribeyes and strips and tenderloin. There's so many cuts off the shoulder, so many cuts off the leg. The consumer has many more options, but it's also really daunting because if you don't have somebody that can kind of talk them through that process of how to cook it, they're going to get the wrong thing for what they want to do.
So years ago, people had a local butcher that they could mm-hmm. go and talk to, and they could say, I wanted to make this on the weekend. Yeah. What should I use? He would tell them what was the best thing, go in the back, you know, cut it up for them, bring it back and give it to you. So you are now that person.
Yeah.
You have become that person for us.
Sure.
So everyone listening, you are now our local, this is Brian, our local butcher. Give us some of the easiest examples of how to go and find, because we all want to buy and eat as well as we possibly can. So we're in the supermarket, we're looking for grass-fed beef, where we can find it. What are some of the mistakes that we're making when we're cooking meat?
I think, the first thing is to find the cut that is the best for what you're doing. You may want a ribeye, and that's totally great. That's awesome, right? But there are other cuts that are certainly less expensive, a little bit more affordable, and just as flavorful. So I personally look for things that are really quick cooking. I don't have a lot of time, so I want something quick. So I tend to look at things off of the shoulder, which have a lot of flavor. Shoulders are locomotion muscles. They move. There's a lot of work in there. Our animals are grass-fed and pastured, so they're going to be alive a lot longer. So that's developing a lot more flavor in that muscle just from all that movement. So cuts like Denver steaks, if you will, off the shoulder, flat irons, things like that, they have good amount of marbling. There's tenderness to it. So we've exalted tenderness as this thing that we must have, which is just, you know, kind of ridiculous. My least favorite cut would be tenderloin, unless it's obviously, you know, wrapped in bacon and made into beef Wellington, if you will. But so we've exalted tenderness and we've forgotten about flavor. We've forgotten about the texture when we chew and all those really great things. And I think those shoulder cuts really have all those things. There's tenderness there, but there's some chew. Not chewy, which is different than chew. We want to be able to chew.
So once you find a shoulder cut, once you say, okay, I'm going to go with this kind of meat, how are we cooking it? What's the best thing to do when you get it home?
So I know a lot of the advice that people get are from, you know, cooking magazines and Foods and Wines and Bon Appetit and on websites and things like that. And they're definitely not wrong. Those are great resources for how to cook and all those sorts of things. But a lot of that information is being given by chefs, and chefs cook in their kitchen. I don't have a kitchen like a chef. I'm sure most people don't. So there's some different things. First of all, I'm not a big fan of bringing things up to room temp. That'll never happen, certainly within any kind of time frame that you need. So what I like to do is salt, super important. Salt flavors, salt tenderizes, right? So I like to salt pretty liberally to begin with, and I toss it back in the fridge, because what's going to happen is that salt's going to draw the moisture out of the meat. But that refrigerator, it's a desiccant, right? It's a dehumidifier. So it's going to dry that meat, right? So you want a nice dry surface, because when you get it in that skillet, you start to hear that sizzle.
So how long do you let that salt do its work?
So about an hour, right?
You can see, that's so interesting to me just right off the bat, because I consider myself to be quite handy in the kitchen. And I am the person in our house that's saying, do not put the salt on until the last minute, because I do not want it drawing out everything from the meat.
You are never going to, like, 75% water, I think, is what a mussel is made of, maybe a little less or something like that. You are you're not making charcuterie. You're just seasoning a steak.
Okay. Perfect. I'm changing immediately. I'm going to do it differently tonight.
And you'll notice the change in flavor.
So now, what is the change?
If it's a thinner piece, obviously you don't have to go that long, but an hour is a pretty good rule of thumb. Okay. I mean, it's just going to tenderize it, and salt adds to the flavor profile, right? Salt is going to react with the proteins in the meat, right? And certainly all those flavor compounds and all those amino acids.
So it's going to come out salted from the fridge, cold. What are we doing then?
So then you're just going to get your skillet nice and hot. You can put a little bit of oil in there. Usually what I like to do sometimes, if it's a piece of meat that has a nice fat cap, I'll actually start it down on the fat, render that fat a little bit, and then turn it onto the muscle side. And then there's really, I wrote a column for Food Republic for a couple of years, and it was always this sort of back and forth, because they would always love to write, and it was great and it was awesome. But they would always do the headlines, and it would say, you know, the best way or the only way. I'm so not that person that says this is the only way. Right. This is the best way is the way that gets you what you want to do. And I'm not the person to tell you the best way to do it. But I am the person to tell you.
But it sounds good so far, because I can't wait to go home and do it.
So you can do anything. You know, I like really thinner, sort of quick pan sticks, like a flat iron. So really, when it comes out, pat it with a little paper towel, make sure it's nice and dry, and then right into your skillet. And something like that takes, you know, 3-4 minutes each side, if that. And then you're done. For thicker cuts, there's a lot of different ways. There's, you know, brown it on both sides and then pop it in the oven. You can reverse sear it, which is you cook it in the oven first at a little bit lower of a temp and then pull it out and sear it on the stovetop. There's a lot of different ways for that. If you're cooking roasts, right, you know, I always like to do a lower temp. I know most recipes call for 350. Mm-hmm. And there's a whole reason why all magazines and everything says 350. But 300, I find, is a better temp to do that at, because it just gives a nice, more even cook all the way around. It'll take a little bit longer, but the result is going to be much better.
How about the difference between putting something, like putting your steak that you've salted and had in the fridge now for an hour, putting it right into like your cast iron pan, or taking it outside and putting it directly onto a flame? Is one better than the other, or is that just absolutely your choice? Because I find sometimes a cast iron pan gets the most fantastic results with meat. But everyone in my house wants the flame off the barbecue.
I am a flat cooking surface fan. So I understand why people like that char and the flavor and all that, but I want to preserve all the goodness that's in that meat, right? We've done something really special at Canoa, is that we've raised grass-fed cattle that marble really well. I don't want to incinerate that fat up in flames. I want that meat to render in that fat. So when you cook on a flat cooking surface, like a cast iron or skillet or whatever, all that fat is going to stay there. You don't have to eat it, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you can siphon it off or whatever, but like, you want it to cook because that's the flavor. Plus, animal fats are super healthy for you.
Yeah, got it. What are some of the things that you see people doing, Brian, that, I mean, not to criticize anybody, because we're all just doing our best here, but what are the things that if you could go into someone's kitchen and say, no, don't do that, do this, it's so easy, what would be a couple of the things that people could adopt right away, like I'm adopting everything that you're saying so far?
I don't know. You know, I'm apprehensive about saying that you're doing it wrong. Like, nobody ever wants to be told.
Right, and I'm not saying we're doing it wrong. Just, okay, if you were in the kitchen, what would you be doing, for example, with certain cuts?
So the things that I just said, I think one of the most important things, and I think sort of chefs and the like, we can all agree on, is the letting the meat rest. And so people are so just like they're ready to eat, right? It's all the smells are in the air and all that sort of thing. But really, I think the most important thing is to let meat rest. You know, so what you've got is you've got a piece of meat that has muscle fibers and they're super tense from all that heat. And then you've got the oil, the fat, right, which is really thin from the heat. So if you were to cut into that piece of meat without letting it cool, you've got muscle fibers that are stressed and oils and fats that are really thin, it's just all going to leach right out. So what you want to do is you want to let it relax a little bit, right? 5 minutes or so for a thick cut steak. And those muscle fibers become less tense.
And then more.
That fat gets a little more viscous and it doesn't just leach out of it. You kind of retain all that goodness. Yeah.
How about, I know people who are absolutely can't look at a piece of meat without battering it with a mallet, like to tenderize it, mm-hmm. as they say. Is there value in that with some cuts, or should you never do that? And certainly with Canoa beef, I would imagine you would never need to, because it's already coming to us at very high quality.
Yeah, I think there are so many things that can be done to mitigate against something being tough and chewy before it even gets to the consumer, yeah. that you don't have to adulterate it with a mallet, or there's a device called the Jacquard, which is a device that has sort of spikes in it,
right.
that pierces it. Because what you're doing there then is you're changing the texture of the meat. And so it's going, you know, and so that mouthfeel is going to be different. It's going to taste different. So our job as butchers, jobs as ranchers and slaughtermen and all those sorts of things are to do everything we can to make sure that carcass and then that piece of meat is treated in a way that's going to make sure that the consumer gets what they want, right? A tasty, tender, delicious piece of meat.
And all locally farmed and grass-fed. And really, this is, I think, the most exciting thing for people who are really trying to make that effort to eat well. You know, even if you only can once or twice a week feed your children, feed your family something that's grass-fed and locally grown and locally produced, you're really taking huge strides into, I think, just that whole thing about sitting down and cooking and taking the time and having and talking to your family about this came from a farm on Kauai. This came here from Oahu. I think it's so important. A lot of our chefs are so forward-thinking. We are so fortunate. In the past 15, 20 years, we've seen great strides in the kinds of restaurants that have opened. And I know that a lot of our restaurants are big supporters of Kunoa. You have great relationships with them. We won't like pick out, you know, our favorites, but we will say that you can find Canoa products at many local restaurants. We're going to put a link up with all of them on the website, so you know where to find them. Yeah. And what's your, like, after a day of butchery and when you go home, what to you is like, oh, I'm so looking forward to eating this. What's your favorite? I mean, is it beef or is it
pork? I eat a lot of chicken.
Yeah.
I eat a lot of chicken and I eat a lot of pork. Uh-huh. I like burgers. To me, that's the key to really good beef. If you can't make a good burger, mm-hmm. you can't do anything else right.
There you
go. That's the most important thing. And I think we make a hell of a good burger at Canoa.
There you go. We're going to go and try it. Now, I do think that all you've done, Brian, is just sort of whet our appetites for more information. One of the videos that's online that we're going to send a link to is you really with one whole pig. We didn't even mention pork. We didn't even mention chicken. I think we have to talk more about just how to cook everything in our kitchen. So if you have time, we'd love to have you come back and chat with us.
Absolutely. Thank you. I'd love to.
Thank you. Brian Mayer is the Director of Product at Canoa. We will have all these links so you can go and find out more about their wonderful, sustainable, grass-fed farming and support them because we're all in this together. It's been an absolute joy to talk to you today. Thank you so much for being with us. We are going to go and get busy and put everything up on our website. We'll see you next time. Thanks for being with us. We hope you enjoyed this podcast. For more information, remember, go check out our website, mojomcgarry.com. We'll see you next time.